Peter Schickele from the PDQ Bach on the Air album. This is Fresh Air on WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Well, you know, this has been a big week for 18th century composers, but with Bach's 300th birthday last week and the film Amadeus's sweep last night at the Academy Awards, well, fine, but where are the tributes to the work of the recently discovered composer PDQ Bach, the last and least of J.S. Bach's children who lived from 1807 to 1742? Well, PDQ Bach will be saluted tomorrow and Thursday nights in concerts by Peter Schickele in the Mendelssohn Club. PDQ Bach is the creation of my guest, Peter Schickele, who has passed on PDQ Bach's legacy in concert and in his work as the head of the Department of Musical Pathology at the University of Southern North Dakota in Hoopole. Schickele's classical music satires, like the Toot Sweet, the Erotica Variations, Iphigenia in Brooklyn, and the Pervertimento for Bagpipes, Bicycle, and Balloons, have been amusing concertgoers and record listeners since the mid-60s. For serious music scholars of PDQ Bach, he's even written a book titled The Definitive Biography of PDQ Bach. Schickele grew up in Ames, Iowa, and Fargo, North Dakota. He studied at Swarthmore College and Juilliard. He will join the Mendelssohn Club for benefit performances tomorrow and Thursday evenings in celebration of Bach's 300th birthday. It's at the Academy of Music, and for information, you can call 893-1931. That's 893-1931. By the way, also in celebration of Bach's 300th, Schickele has written the introduction to the book Happy Birthday, Bach. Peter Schickele, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Great pleasure for me.
How did you celebrate Bach's birthday?
Well, as I think is often the lot of the professional musician, I celebrated it by going from one city to another on an airplane and having a rehearsal.
Sounds exciting.
Yes, oddly enough, I performed the night before his birthday and the night after his birthday, the first being in New York City, the second in Buffalo, New York. But the actual day was spent really in transit and rehearsing, which is probably what he did on his birthday.
And I wanted to know as well what you thought of the film Amadeus, which got so many Academy Awards last night.
Well, I thought it was a very exciting film. I have funny sort of feelings about Amadeus, but I think that Murray Abraham's performance as Salieri was one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen. I thought it was just beautiful, and I've seen him around for a long time because he had a kid in the school in Brooklyn that my kids went to, Brooklyn Friends School. So I used to see him waiting for his kids, and I had seen him both on the stage and in a couple of movies that not many people saw. There was a movie called The Big Fix, in which he played a sort of an A.B. Hoffman kind of guy who went underground. He was also tremendous in. And I am just so tickled that he has finally gotten where he ought to be in terms of, obviously, what this means to an actor is much more important than anything in terms of income or something like that. It's just that you're going to be offered a tremendous range of stuff to do, and you can choose what you want to do.
Peter Schickele, since you're the biographer of PDQ Bach, and since you really discovered him and have perpetuated his legacy, so to speak, let's talk a little bit about the man and his music. How did you first discover the work of PDQ Bach?
Well, I'm glad to hear that you've amended your earlier approach of referring to me as the creator of PDQ Bach. Now, I don't like to take on these quasi-religious overtones. As far as I'm concerned, there's only one creator of all of us, and I am the sole discoverer of the music of PDQ Bach. I first ran across his music when I was looking for lost Johann Sebastian Bach cantatas, of which there are many. And I was traveling around Europe, and I found in a castle in southern Bavaria, the Lechendach Schloss, the castle of the leaking roof, being used as a strainer in the coffee maker belonging to the caretaker, a manuscript of the Sanka Cantata by PDQ Bach. Now, I'd heard of the coffee cantata of Johann Sebastian Bach, one of his rare, perhaps fortunately rare, attempts at humor, but I had never heard of the Sanka Cantata, nor had I heard of PDQ Bach. So I took the manuscript back to the University of Southern North Dakota at Hoopole and had it performed. Hearing the performance explained the atrocious taste of the coffee, but not who this enigmatic composer was. Well, that was in 1954. And since then, I have discovered over 75 works by PDQ Bach. That's a real oeuvre. Everything from small things such as the three teeny preludes to piano for piano right up to a full-scale opera, The Abduction of Figaro. So there seems to be no form that he left unsullied, and in general, it's been something that has just completely gotten out of bounds.
Is there any musical justification for the obscurity that he's faced?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. He was, of course, born into a family whose name was quite literally synonymous with music in the 18th century. You would say in those days that somebody was a real Bach, the way you might say a wonderful actor was a real Olivier or something like that these days. And so to have a son, if you were Johann Sebastian Bach, to have a son who was incapable of carrying a tune was a severe embarrassment. And it's perhaps understandable that the Bach family destroyed letters, did everything they could to try to make it seem as if he never existed. But I think it's important, historically speaking, to realize that there were incompetent clods writing music just as much then as there are now. And I think that it's important not to suppress P.D.Q. Bach and leave this impression that Johann Sebastian Bach could do no wrong whatsoever. I think it's important to show the whole rounded picture, including the seamy underbelly. Also, the more of P.D.Q. Bach's music that's discovered, the more it's becoming apparent that he actually deserves a lot of credit that has been given to other people. His music was very forward-looking for whatever reason. I think much of the credit given Bill Monroe for the development of the bluegrass sound, obviously with the discovery of the cantata Blaues Gras, belongs with P.D.Q. Bach. And similarly, there are a lot of licks, as we might call them now, that sound very much like jazz or rock or something that that indicate that P.D.Q. Bach was certainly one of the biggest heads of his time.
What do his initials stand for?
Well, the initials themselves stand for nothing, which could be said of P.D.Q. himself for most of his life. Johann Sebastian Bach had already had 20 children. And in those days, you know, they didn't have very many names. They just worked with the same four or five names and rearranged them in different orders. And by the time he'd had 20 children, Bach announced that he'd run out of names. And from here on in, it was going to be just initials. So he wouldn't have even gotten those if Wilhelm Friedmann, who was one of the few members of the family that was friendly to P.D.Q., he was his oldest brother, he insisted when P.D.Q. was five that his father give him some sort of appellation. I mean, up until then, he was just called Boy and just sort of kicked around underfoot. But Wilhelm Friedmann thought that he should have some sort of a name, some sort of a appellation. And so they went to a particular well in town where they got water, and you looked down into the well and saw the shape of a name. It was known as the Appalachian Spring. And they went there and saw the initials P.D.Q. in the water, and that was how he got his name.
Now, how do you find all this out? You must have done an incredible amount of research into his past.
Well, I have. Ever since the discovery of that first piece, I've done everything I can to find them. And I must say, I do seem to have a propensity, a knack for running across these pieces. And it takes something like that, because you won't find them in your typical library or museum. It's no surprise that there were no P.D.Q. Bach manuscripts found in that recent trove that included the 33 chorale preludes by his father, Johann Sebastian. Or were there? Now, that's an interesting question. I think maybe there was something in there that, typically enough, was suppressed by the AMJ, because ever since I first started bringing out P.D.Q. Bach's music, the American Musicological Junta has been quite active in trying to suppress my activities, just as the family did 200 years ago with the original composer.
When a musicologist such as you devotes his life to the study of one composer, I imagine that the influence of that composer's life and writing begins to wear off on you. Has it affected you in any way?
Well, I have to admit that it has. One of the characteristics that's most often associated with P.D.Q. Bach is that characteristic that has been called manic plagiarism. And that certainly seems to have worn off on me. I've written several works, the Unbegun Symphony, the Quodlibet, the Chacun à son goût, the Eine kleine Nichtmusik, which seemed to consist entirely of themes that other composers thought up as well. And I think that this is due to the fact that I spend so much time with the music of P.D.Q. Bach.
Have you thought about when the movie is made, celebrating his life, who will play the leading role?
I certainly have thought about that because I hope very much that someday P.D.Q. Bach's life will be the subject of a movie. Naturally, I can't pretend not to have certain hopes in that direction myself, even though, of course, I'm not really an actor. I'm a musicologist. But since I am associated so much with P.D.Q. Bach, and people have even noticed a certain facial resemblance between myself and P.D.Q., which is actually why I grew the beard, I have had some sort of hopes that might be ascribed to vanity, but whether they are or not, they're certainly vain hopes.
Well, why don't we listen to one of the P.D.Q. Bach compositions that you have discovered and have made available to we, the listening public. Why don't we listen to the chorale of the Blaues Grass?
Well, what I thought we might do, with your permission, is hear the chorale and the duet. I'll go right to the end of the cantata. The cantata Blaues Grass, the Bluegrass Cantata, was written for a local band around the turn of the century, that is around 1800, a local band called Tommy Mann and His Magic Mountain Boys. And the two movements we're going to hear are the chorale, Ich gehe am Krüppelbach hinauf, which goes, the chorus sings, I go up Cripple Creek, and the bass sings, Go I now up Cripple Creek. The tenor and the bass, Go I Now Up Cripple Creek, and the two of them sing Amen. Then we have the finale, which is a duet, Zagmir, and the tenor says, Tell me, is this creek very deep? The bass says, Can't be. One of my ducks forded it this morning. A little bit of Baroque humor there. Then the bass says, Mister, do you want us to build your house from the bottom up or from the top down? Tenor says, Well, from the bottom up, naturally. Bass says, consarn it, we have to tear it down and start all over again. Then there's a very enigmatic line. A soldier sings the line, very interesting but stupid. Then the bass sings, till we meet again. The tenor, may we never meet again. The two of them sing, I'll say amen to that. And then a very enigmatic line that I assume had some sort of local meaning in southern Germany at that point. They sing, das ist ein großes Zehnfer, guter Kamerad. That is a big 10-4, good buddy.
Well, shall we hear it?
Why don't we? I don't think we should put it off any longer.
Kann nicht sein, eine meiner Enten ist heute Morgen durchgewartet. Mein Herr, Wollen Sie, dass wir Ihr Haus von unten heraufbauen oder von oben herunterbauen?
Aber natürlich von unten herauf.
Ach, verdammte Mist, wir müssen es abreißen und von neuem anfangen.
Sehr interessant, aber dumm.
Also auf Wiedersehen,
also auf Wiedersehen, bis alle Arme dazu.
Also auf Wiedersehen,
also auf Wiedersehen, bis alle Arme dazu.
Ein großes Zehnvier, gute Kamera.
That was the last two movements from the Cantata Blaues Gras, the bluegrass cantata by P.D.Q. Bach, John Ferrante tenor, well, modesty forbids me, singing bass, the New York Pickup Ensemble, conducted by Robert Bernhardt.
Peter Shigley, let's talk a little bit about you. Why do you focus so much on 18th century music in your satire? Were you going to play music influenced by that style yourself?
Basically what I am is a composer. And I think that P.D.Q. Bach grew very gradually. It did not start with a career in mind at all. It was something that started with friends in a living room in Fargo, North Dakota, and then it started semi-publicly as concerts put on at Juilliard and also at Aspen in the summer for fellow faculty and students. And then finally in 1965, the first real public performance. And it was never planned, it just sort of happened in the beginning, but in retrospect, it seems very obvious to me that this is a prime example of the thing that has always seemed true to me, and that is that most satirists make fun of what they like, not what they don't like. I think it's no accident that Spike Jones, who was the granddaddy of it all for me, I was a Spike Jones freak when I was a kid, the water he swam in was the 30s and 40s big band style, dance band kind of thing. He even put out records with Spike Jones and his other orchestra that were straight without comedy. And when rock and roll came along in the 50s, he hated it. He said, rock and roll sounds like a parody of itself already. And to me, it's no surprise that he wasn't as good at doing takeoffs of rock and roll as he was on the music that he loved. And since Bach and Mozart are two of my absolute favorite composers, and there's an affinity there, a stylistic affinity, that is the only reason that decades later I'm still having fun doing this, because if I were taking off a composer that I don't have an affinity to, somebody like Wagner or Debussy, and there's music by both those composers that I love, but I mean they're not my – there isn't that natural sort of hookup that you have with certain people. I would have been – well, I wouldn't be still doing it. I would have run out of ideas a long time ago. The thing about Bach's style and Mozart's style is that, completely aside from the humor, I love doing things with the style for its musical sake. Perhaps a little bit without equating in the wrong way, but perhaps a little bit the way Stravinsky did with Pergolesi and Pulcinella or Tchaikovsky and The Fairy's Kiss, that there's a musical delight there as well as anything that you'd call more obviously a gag.
Did the character come to you fully sprung?
Not really. That also was very casual. As a matter of fact, my brother was the one who came up with the three creative periods, the initial plunge, the soused period, and contrition. He did that, and this is all before anything was public. This was just fooling around. The first public concert was in 1965, and in 66 I signed a contract with Random House to do a book on PDQ Bach. Well, it took me 10 years to actually get the book done. I just am basically a composer. I would sit down at home with a typewriter, and within half an hour I'd be over at the piano writing a song or a piece or something like that instead of doing what I was, quote, supposed to be doing, end quote. And finally I got re-inspired in about 1975 about a whole new look for the book of having a lot more graphics in it than I had intended to originally. And the only way I could get it done was by renting an office where there was nothing to do but work on the book. There was no piano. What is interesting looking back is that I think the book is much better having been written in 1975, 76 than it would have been if I had done it right at the beginning there, because the whole character had become richer. He had a lot more history by then. And to me, the focus is very much the music. The piece comes first, and then the biographical data accrues around it. And so I think it's one of those things that that worked out for the best, even though the reason at the time felt like procrastination.
You grew up in Ames, Iowa, and in Fargo, North Dakota. Was there much of a classical music scene in either of those two places?
Well, we moved from Ames when I was 8 years old. I don't have any particular memory of that. I wasn't particularly interested in music as a kid. I was not a prodigy at all. I didn't get interested in music really at all until I was 12, 13. We lived for 4 years at the end of World War II in Washington, D.C., and then I moved to Fargo. And it was then that I got interested in music, partly because Spike Jones had such a wonderful stage show. I was very theatrically inclined. I was much more interested in theater than music when I was 11 years old. And it was really in an imitation of Spike Jones' stage show that I put together the first little band I was in. It was a four-man band called Jerky Jims and His Bommy Brothers. It featured two clarinets, violin, and tom-tom. And
what a combination.
I just did a record signing, and a kid showed up who's the father of the other clarinet, who was the son of the other clarinetist. So things have a tendency to come back at you. But so that during the teenage years, what happened was that I got just more and more involved in the music for its own sake and less in the theater. But what's interesting is that since Fargo is one of those towns that is often used as the quintessentially podunky town, my memories of Fargo are extremely lively. My brother was and is a fanatic chamber music player. He's a filmmaker now in San Francisco, but he still plays viola whenever he can in quartets. And he was always talking kids into coming over and playing quartets. Not only that, but among the adults, some of our best friends were the conductor of the community orchestra, which, by the way, in 1950 played Messiaen. And we were getting together at homes playing the Schubert two cello quintet and the Mozart and Beethoven quartets particularly, and also the Brahms sextets and quintets. And it's not what people associate with Fargo, North Dakota at all. It was a very lively scene. When I went east to go to college, first to Swarthmore College and then to Juilliard, I've always kept that sort of amateur standing along with my professional standing, in the sense that I still love writing rounds to be sung at parties. And a lot of my best pieces started out as birthday presents for somebody or something like that. And that very much comes from that atmosphere of Fargo. There was a composer who was there a generation older than I, and when he moved from Fargo, I sort of picked up the tradition of living room operas, little operas written for a party, basically, which would be rehearsed in secret and then performed.
I understand that you were the only music major in Swarthmore. Is that true?
At the time, it was, yes. Certainly, the Swarthmore music department has grown tremendously since the 50s when I was there.
Competition must have been really keen.
The competition was something wild. Now, I think that I heard that they had had a music major or two before that, but at the time I was there, there were none, and there weren't even enough courses for me to take. I had to come independent and take a couple of courses there. There was a very active musical life, though. As a matter of fact, it was a little bit like Fargo. I mean, there were concerts every Sunday afternoon, all put on by students. And I had four orchestral pieces played by the Swarthmore Orchestra, one each year I was there. And so I was just writing music and hearing it all the time. I mean, hearing the music I wrote. But by the time I graduated from Swarthmore, I was very aware that I needed to get to someplace more serious musically. I mean, I went to Juilliard. On the other hand, when I got to Juilliard, I felt sort of glad in some ways that I'd been to Swarthmore because so many of the students at Juilliard were just had complete blinders on and were only interested in the violin or the cello or whatever it was. And I think in looking back on it all, the way my life has turned out, I don't think, for instance, that the definitive biography of P.D.Q. Bach would be what it is without that education I got at Swarthmore. In other words, my life has turned out to be more than just composing. It has this whole historical eggshell around it that I think was very nurtured by the education I got at Swarthmore.
What kind of music do you think you were going? Did you think you were going to compose when you first went to Juilliard?
Well, I assumed that I would end up being a college teacher or something and writing. I mean, I knew what I wanted to do was write, and that's the sort of the way you made your living in those days if you were going to be a composer. I think that I've always been very, well, fond is even the wrong expression. I've always loved all sorts of non-classical kinds of music in addition to classical music. I've always loved all sorts of folk and jazz and rock and ethnic music from around the world. And I've always tried as much as possible to keep myself open to that. And I use that expression very particularly because I think that just wanting to combine things is different from actually being able to do it convincingly. I feel that very much about a lot of the third stream music that was written in the 60s. Most of those combinations of jazz and avant-garde I felt were very self-conscious and didn't really work. I have always tended towards the lyric and expressive, and I don't feel that the word charm is a dirty word, as many composers perhaps do. And I think that what's happened is over the decades is that I feel that gradually those different kinds of music have had their influence on mine. I now write a piece that is a regular chamber music piece in terms of its instrumentation or in general form, but it'll have a lot of jazz or rock kinds of things in it. I use drones a lot, which partially came from the fad of listening to a lot of Indian music in the 60s, you know, and partially from drone instruments such as a bagpipe and even the mountain dulcimer. So that it feels, when I was in high school, I used to play in dance bands and square dance bands as well as classical music kinds of things.
When you were in Juilliard, were you exposed to a lot of pretensions there, since part of what you do in your concerts is parody those pretensions? I figured you must be pretty well acquainted with them.
Yes, although some of the things are not as direct as they might seem. In other words, some of the sort of whole lecture part of it refers as much to some lecture courses I've had in other subjects. For instance, at Swarthmore, there was an art history lecture. Now, it happens to have been a very good course. As a matter of fact, it was your standard basic art history course that exposed you to the standard basic things. If it were music, it would have, I suppose, been the Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and the Messiah and stuff like that. But for somebody who had been very unexposed to all that stuff, it was very exciting for me. I thought it was a tremendous course. But still, that thing about working with slides and everything is something that in the program I have called the Intimate P.D.Q. Bach Program, which is a self-contained four-man show. It contains a 20-minute illustrated slide lecture on the life and times of P.D.Q. Bach, and a lot of the things come from courses like that. So they're not all music courses. And also, I think a lot of the pretension has come not necessarily from Juilliard, which I think actually was. I don't have any contact with the school now. But was a quite an unpretentious place. It tended to be a sort of a working musician type place in the composition department particularly. It was not a very dogmatic place. It was quite eclectic. But all you had to do in the 60s was just read program notes for contemporary music, for instance, to see some of the most amazing prose ever written. These descriptions of this piece uses the row, looking through it as if you were for looking from one corner of a cube to the other, with the dotted lines drawn to a right angle to that, indicating the notes that are used in the left hand of the piano part, that kind of thing. And so, and for instance, some liner notes are pretty good too. So that I think the inspirations come from a lot of different places, and I certainly wouldn't want to pin any rap on Juilliard in that sense.
Do you think that there's any classical composers that we treat a little too sanctimoniously?
Yes, I think my feeling about that is that a lot of people don't realize that the people who wrote that music weren't as stuffy as the atmosphere of concert halls suggests that they were. But what I do feel in saying that, I do would like to say that the music is very serious, just like a lot of other music is. And so what I'm saying is because I think concerts could be a lot less stuffy, doesn't mean that I think we ought to have slideshows with symphonies or, try to sort of jazz it up some way to get people interested. Maybe that's fun to do too. I certainly love hearing the Swingle Singers do Bach, even though it doesn't take the place of the original. But I do feel that the atmosphere surrounding music in the 18th century was probably closer to the atmosphere that we're familiar with now in terms of, a jazz group or something that is very serious in preparing its music, but often more lighthearted in its presentation. For instance, one of the things that annoys me is that because of my reputation, I can't give a light title to a serious piece, because if I do, everybody's going to be looking for something specifically funny. Whereas in jazz, you very often get flippant titles for pieces that are just straightforward jazz pieces. You get a piece called Bike Up the Strand or something like that. It's just a piece. It's not a joke piece. And I think that that kind of thing, another thing that's in common, I think, is that jazz people often are sort of, when they play in a club, they're often fighting an audience that's talking and everything like that. I have a feeling that that was true in the 18th century very often, too. I can't believe, if you look at the programs of those concerts in Beethoven's day that must have gone on for 3 or 4 hours sometimes, when you read that the Handel organ concertos were written to be played between the acts of the oratorios, I can't believe that the audiences sat there the way we sit at a concert now. I'm sure there was a lot of noise. You read in the 19th century that some of the great chess matches were played at the opera in a box, So I think the attitude was very different. And I don't even say that's the way it ought to be. I like getting myself completely engrossed in a piece. I don't like audiences that make noise. But I think you pay a price, We have this thing now that you shouldn't applaud after movements. In the 19th century, if the audience liked a movement, they applauded sometimes to the point where they had to play the movement over again. Now, you can say that that destroys the architecture of the symphony, but it's also something that comes out of a tremendous spontaneous enthusiasm. Mozart wrote home when he did the Paris Symphony, the last movement of which starts not with a big tutti, a big loud thing right away that everybody usually expects in a symphony, but it starts with just the first and second violins scurrying around, and then finally, 10 seconds into it or whatever it is, the whole orchestra comes blazing in. Apparently the audience was delighted and burst into applause right then when the orchestra came in, and Mozart wrote that home proudly because he'd obviously got them, He had delighted them. And I think the price we pay for the very serious approach, and as I say, I'm of two minds about it because I like not being distracted, but the price we pay is a lack of spontaneity.
Well, speaking of serious approaches, when you make your entrance in your concerts, so you've entered in some most unusual ways. Do you want to describe some of the entrances you've made?
Well, now these, of course, are in PDQ Bach concerts. The professor does have a habit of not being able to find the stage door of auditoriums, and so I've been known to end up in the balcony, and the only way I can get down quickly to the orchestra floor is by shimmying down a rope from the balcony to the aisle or swinging in from the front of the balcony like Tarzan. It's true that this has happened. But I think that to do that in a concert of Peter Schickele music would be to raise false expectations. So I try to find the right door in that case.
Did you ever hurt yourself doing that?
Never seriously. I bruised myself up a bit once in a while. I chipped a tooth once, but I've never done anything serious.
Did you let the audience know what had happened?
Or no.
Did you act like nothing happened?
Right.
I think people really enjoy entering a symphony hall or a place like the Academy of Music and having such wild shenanigans happen in what's usually such a kind of serious place.
Well, I think that's very much part of it. I give concerts annually in New York, New York City, in the last week of December. It's been going on for 20 years now. And we often try to have something a little bit beside the concert going on. We once had a saxophone quartet out in the lobby of Carnegie Hall playing Eine Kleine Nachtmusik on four saxophones. Years ago, we had live music in the men's room and the ladies' room. Instead of Muzak, we figured, why not live players? So we had a string quartet in the ladies' room. And, we once had a harpist being carted around. She was dressed in white, playing. And one of the nicest things was that one year, the audience came into Carnegie Hall, and over the PA system, we were playing Muzak-type music. music for young lovers kind of stuff. And it worked so well that we took the tape with us on tour. And the first place we played was down south someplace, and it was in one of those places that's sort of a combination auditorium and gymnasium and used for school dances and concerts and basketball and stuff like that. And it just wasn't nearly as funny, because what made it so great is to come into Carnegie Hall, of all places, and hear this syrupy Jackie Gleason-type music, you know. It just, the context, as you were saying, the context is part of what makes it work. And one of the reasons I feel that it's very difficult very often when I do appearances on television, on talk shows and stuff, is that television is so quick. You have to do whatever you're going to do in a minute and a half or 2 minutes. And PDQ Bach works best, I think, when you sort of get into it. You get into the whole persona and the whole atmosphere, you know, of it. And so the context has a great deal to do with it.
You know, there's a lot of people now who are returning to original instruments. Do you feel like you're partially responsible for that trend?
Well, I would like to think that. It may be a little bit presumptuous of me to think that. But I think that there's some fortuitous timing there. One of the things that somebody pointed out was that in the middle 60s, when PDQ Bach was first starting, was right about the period that the first blossoming of the LP record had happened, when they were recording every symphony of Haydn and every concerto of Vivaldi and everything that Bach ever wrote. And I think some people were suffering from what a friend of mine called Baroque backlash. And so that, as I say, even though my approach to it is that I never decided on what was on the stylistic arena because of any decision of what would go well or what would go over. It was completely an intuitive musical decision. Nevertheless, I think that sort of fit in, that it came along at that time. And now, of course, that the original instrument thing has become so strong, and of course PDQ Bach wrote for so many instruments which have remained quite original, the windbreaker and the left-handed sewer flute and the bicycle, that fits in very nicely. A lot of things happen, even though it's not planned that way. I'm often asked if one of the reasons I do PDQ Bach is to get people who weren't before interested in classical music. And it's not at all. I mean, I have no educational aims in mind. But in point of fact, I find that happens. I've had people tell me they've gotten interested in classical music through it. I also have talked to teachers all over the country who use the Beethoven Sportscast, for instance, as an introduction to sonata form or the symphony. And of course, the reason it works is that it's like Anna Russell telling the story of the ring. It's basically true, and that's what makes it both funny and also educational. But that isn't the impetus. The impetus is to have a good time.
Your PDQ Bach works are loaded with all kinds of musical in-jokes. Are there any jokes or, you know, musical puns in there that no one's really gotten yet, as far as you can tell?
Well, there are some that are almost more for the orchestra than for the audience. There's a work called the Chacana Songu, which is one of the works made up of quotes from other pieces. And there's one place where the violas and the clarinets play a theme from one of the two Brahms clarinet sonatas, which Brahms also arranged for viola. Now, both those two instruments are instruments which don't have a lot of first-class great literature written for them, so they both feel very understandably particularly attached to those pieces in a way that it wouldn't be true of a violinist, somebody who has just a wonderful array of sonatas. And this theme goes on simultaneously with the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, and of course, underneath it all, the Bach Passacaglia theme is playing along all the time. So you've got these three themes going on simultaneously. I would bet that virtually nobody in an audience, even people who know that theme, I think probably can't sort it out. Or they could perhaps if you said, listen for this theme in the clarinets and violas. But just with the piece going by, I would bet that even musicians who know that work probably don't really catch that. But it's – but everybody laughs at the ba-dum, ta-dum, 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 ta-dum. So it doesn't matter. And for me, it's worth it at the first rehearsal to watch the faces of the violists and clarinetists who just get such a kick out of the fact that somebody else knows one of their pieces.
What happens when – well, I don't know if this has ever happened, but have you ever been at a concert where the musicians were laughing in the middle of it and, you know, just – ruining the concert by laughing along with the joke instead of being straight-faced?
Well, actually, I don't ask them to be straight-faced anymore. When I first started appearing with the symphony orchestras, I did, and I found that it sort of puts a wet blanket on it. When I'm appearing with my own group, the intimate PDQ Bach, we are very serious. But I've found with a symphony orchestra, the atmosphere is better if I don't do that. And in fact, I've gone the other direction in that I don't even do everything at the rehearsal. I save some stuff for the performance to be a surprise for the orchestra as well as the audience. It's a very empirical decision and what works, you know. I've found – you see, it's one thing when you're working with your own group, people that you've hired, auditioned, whatever. You put together the intimate PDQ Bach group, for instance, or when we used to in the late 60s travel with a small orchestra that we put together. There you can work with them. You work out the routine. Everything is quite theatrically worked out. In the case of my appearances with a symphony orchestra, I almost never have more than two rehearsals with them, sometimes only one. I don't know these people. Some of these people might be good comedians. Some of them might not. Sometimes they're better comedians than they think they are. I have to sort of discourage participation on their part. But what I have found is that if I tell people not to laugh, it isn't as good a concert as if I tell them don't worry about it. So, and one of the things I found actually is that in cities where the symphony matters, where people really care about their orchestra, usually members of the audience, I don't mean people on the board either, I just mean people who go regularly, they really get to know the orchestra. They have people they particularly like to watch. They maybe know the people, maybe not, but they know them from watching them. And they love seeing them having a good time. I've had so many times people in the audience say, "Well, it's so wonderful to see that first cellist crack up. He's always so serious, you know." And so I think that that's something that's worth having, you know.
My guest is Peter Schickele, who will be performing the works of PDQ Bach tomorrow and Thursday nights with the Mendelssohn Club in a benefit concert at the Academy of Music. When you first started performing, before you were famous, did musicians think twice about playing with you because they thought that they'd be taken as comedians instead of serious musicians and it might have a negative impact on their careers?
Well, there was a certain amount of that. I think the very first humorous concert, it wasn't even called PDQ Bach at Juilliard when I was a student there in 1959. And Jorge Mester and I and some other people put together a teeny little orchestra. Well, he put the orchestra together, but I mean it was probably two first violins and two seconds and a viola and a cello and a bass and a few winds. somebody at Juilliard who had an alumni scholarship on piano had to, as part of his scholarship, play a recital. And the person who organized the concerts at Juilliard came up to me once and said, look, this guy has to play a recital, but he's only got half a program. He said, I've heard you and your friends talking about all these funny things you'd like to do in a concert. Here's your chance. You want to do the other half of the concert. And that was the first humorous concert at Juilliard. It wasn't even a full concert. And the quodlibet was written for that concert, literally overnight, with friends, including Phil Glass, sitting beside me, taking parts and copying parts as I finished the score. And when it came in the quodlibet to the place where Beethoven's Seventh Symphony is combined with T for Two, at the first and only rehearsal, one of the violinists got up and walked out and never came back. There's nothing we could do about it. It wasn't as if anybody was being paid or if it was a school function or something like that. She didn't want to play. She didn't have to. And so she got up and walked out and never came back. But I think one of the things that was nice is that the fact that I did the concerts for 6 years at Juilliard and at Aspen meant that by the time I did the first public concert in 65, it already had an underground reputation among musicians as something fun to do. So right from the very beginning in New York, and this has remained true, I've worked with the very best freelance musicians, and the PDQ Bach pieces reflect that. Some of them are quite difficult. People are often surprised if they attend a rehearsal at how hard we work on just getting the music right. Because one of the things I learned from Spike Jones is the better played it is, the funnier it is. You know, you don't, it's not goofing off. And so the high trumpet parts, for instance, are, it takes the really good high trumpet players to play them, you know, and it's because I've always had the top musicians. And one of the nice things now, there is such a thing as paying dues. And one of the nice things about having done it as long as I have is that I've played with most of the orchestras in the country and most of the major symphonies and many community and college orchestras. And so they know that I'm not out to make a fool of them. And I'm very careful in my rehearsals to be very respectful of them, because my attitude is that they are not hired to be comedians. They're hired to play the music. And occasionally, I've had a bit that I wanted to do where nobody volunteers to do it, and so we scrap the bit. Because
must be pretty humiliating if nobody volunteers.
Well, usually what I try to do, if it's a particularly exposed thing, you know, particular kind of thing that some people might not want to do, a rather theatrical thing, I usually try to go and talk to the section, the head of the section first, and talk about it before the rehearsal starts officially, so I'm not talking about it in front of everybody. And it very rarely happens that somebody won't volunteer, you know. But if it does happen, as I say, as far as I'm concerned, that's their right.
Did anyone ever say to you that you were ruining your own career and your own chances as a serious musician by focusing so much on the musical satire that you do?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are people who are fans of my serious music that decades ago, or years ago, you know, wished that I had given up PDQ Bach. I think the one thing I would do differently if I had to do it all over again, and the trouble is I love that whole theatrical part of me. I said, you know, when I was 11, if you'd asked me what I was going to be when I grow up, I would have said an actor or a playwright or something like that. That whole side of me, of course, is very satisfied by the very theatrical nature of PDQ Bach concerts. The one thing I would do differently, I think, would be to use a funny, phony name for the professor, not as a secret, but just as a signpost. I mean, not trying to keep my identity a secret, but just so that Peter Schickele could be used for the so-called serious music, and the Professor Hassenfesser or whatever it's going to be would be used for PDQ Bach. Because it is upsetting at a concert that has a serious piece of mine if a bunch of people, as sometimes has happened, come in just determined to find something to laugh at. Very often people don't know that I do anything serious, which isn't surprising, but sometimes when they find out that I do, they're not only surprised but even disappointed. It's sort of like, oh, here's another clown who wants to play Hamlet, you know. And I have no desire to shove my serious music down people's throats. One of the reasons that I work hard on trying to get as much of it recorded as possible is it tends that way to get out to people who are interested in it, and I get very nice feedback from people who've heard it on classical music stations. And But I couldn't put a serious piece on a PDQ Bach concert because everybody would be waiting for something funny to happen.
Right, or figuring that rather than look stupid like they're missing the joke, they just laugh right, even though there wasn't right. one.
When I give a concert, when I'm involved in a concert myself of my serious music, I sometimes am a composer in residence at a university or a chamber music festival, and they do a concert of my chamber music. What I always do is to give the program notes verbally, to introduce the pieces orally. And when I do that, there's never any problem because without being negative about it, I can tell people what to expect. In other words, you don't get up there saying, don't laugh, this isn't a funny piece. That puts a wet dish rag on everything. But just by talking a little bit about the piece, people have some idea of what to expect. And those concerts always go very nicely. I also, in that kind of situation, usually ask if I can do an evening or a program of songs. I also write, just to confuse the issue further, modern, what you might call folk pop songs in the Paul Simon, John Sebastian tradition, which are a very important part of my output. They're very personal songs, a lot of them, about my family and my kids and friends and are certainly some of the best things I've done. But unfortunately, there are only 24 hours in the day and only 12 months in the year, and I'm on the road so much, I'm not ready at this point to have somebody going out there as an agent trying to get as many song programs as possible. So I do those as they come up. People who hear about them tell other people, and I half a dozen times of the year maybe do programs of these songs. And I've decided that just everything being what it is, I like keeping that very low-key. Because there's a lot of pressure that goes into a career, and I sort of like not putting the pressure on those.
We have about a minute left or so. I'd really like to hear, I know you're working on a couple of pieces, one commission piece for New England Conservatory of Music, and also if you could tell us briefly about a PBS broadcast in your future.
Well, the first is a piece I just finished, a big religious work for chorus and jazz ensemble, and a solo baritone too, the solo baritone singer, who should sound sort of folkish more than classical. He sings in English, the chorus sings in Latin from the liturgy, and there's a 10-piece jazz ensemble. I'm going to be conducting the premiere of that on May 8th at the New England Conservatory. And then the PDQ Bach opera is his so far only discovered full-length three-act opera called The Abduction of Figaro, and it was given its premiere by the Minnesota Opera last in April 84 and has been accepted for broadcast by PBS. I've done a real good Alastair Cook introduction for it and everything, and they haven't set a date for it, but it should be sometime in 1985.
Great. Well, I wish you the best with those, and I thank you very much for being here today. It's really been very enjoyable to meet you. Thank you for
my
being
pleasure.
Here. My guest has been Peter Schickley, who will be performing a concert of the works of PDQ Bach tomorrow and Thursday evenings in a benefit performance with the Mendelssohn Club. And I'll give you a phone number you can call for more information, 893-1931. That's 893-1931 for information on the PDQ Bach concert tomorrow and Thursday evenings at the Academy of Music. Also, Peter Schickley's records, the PDQ Bach records, are on Vanguard Records. His book, The Definitive Biography of PDQ Bach is in paperback on Random House, and he's also written the introduction to the new book of humorous sketches called Happy Birthday Bach, and that's just been published by Doubleday. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.